I grew up attending a large, theologically conservative Southern Baptist congregation in the Midlands of South Carolina, specifically that one. So thinking back, and you can think about your own, maybe your relationship with the resurrection has stayed the same, maybe it's evolved and changed over time as mine has. Thinking back, you know, did I literally believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus? I'd say as a young child, you know, more or less. But then with an increasing level of cognitive dissonance as I entered my teenage years. It was more intellectually defensible to believe that the life, the universe, and everything metaphysically changed with the resurrection of Jesus back before the scientific revolution. It's just easier to believe it back then. Back when it made more sense to also believe that the earth is the center of the universe, that the universe is only a few thousand years old, and that we humans are special creations that are central to a divine master plan. As the self-proclaimed evolutionary evangelist Michael Dowd used to say, the problem with many religions is not that they are BC before Christ, you know, missing the special thing that happened with Jesus. The problem is that they're BC before Copernicus. And over the past few centuries, science has deeply challenged traditional religious claims. We now know that we humans are not a little lower than the angels. We are merely a little higher than the apes with whom we share a common ancestor. And the universe is not a few thousand years old, but 13.7 billion years old, and also infinitely vaster than our ancestors could have imagined. Far from being the center of the universe, our planet is merely the third rock from the sun. Our solar system is on the periphery of the much larger Milky Way galaxy, and our galaxy is only one of more than, you know, Carl Sagan used to say billions, right? We now know it's more than 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. This is a James Webb Space Telescope deep field image. Or perhaps we're in a multiverse, right? That's a sermon for another day. So as I grew up and began to study religion and philosophy and science for myself, I entered into this period of disbelief. I began to view the ancient stories of the resurrection not as a historical record of what actually happened, but something like press releases from the public relations and marketing department of early Christianity. If you look at the traditional texts of the Christian creeds as well, they emphasize believing in Jesus' incarnation and virgin birth and the crucifixion, resurrection, ascension, and eventual second coming. Those creeds almost universally just skip right over everything about Jesus that to those of us who are theologically liberal or progressive have always valued most about him, which is his life and teachings. They just skip right over that. As we often say, we believe in deeds, not creeds, and that you don't have to believe alike to love alike. And it is that loving that is central, not believing things, it's actually doing them. So in my early adulthood, I tended more toward either disbelieving a literal resurrection altogether or approaching it increasingly symbolically, metaphorically, even archetypally. As I've entered into middle age, however, I find myself somewhat surprisingly, to my earlier self, more open to messiness and complexity and the ways life turns out to be often more paradoxical than at least I previously thought was the case. To quote my favorite religion scholar, Jeffrey Kripal, there may be a middle way of approaching odd religious experiences that refuse to either fall into either easy reductionistic debunking or naive literalist belief. So on this Easter Sunday, what might that mean specifically in regard to claims about the resurrection? To explore possible responses to that question, I've been reading a book published a few years ago titled The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Polemics, History. It's by Dale Allison, who is a New Testament professor at Princeton Theological Seminary. Apologetics, as Sabrina described earlier, they're arguments in defense of a belief. So you could even think, for my philosophy nerds, Plato's Apology would be like a classic example, defending himself against the haters in Athens. So apologetics, it's like a defense lawyer might make a defense on behalf of their client at trial. Polemics are attacks on an opponent's beliefs, and to the extent possible, Allison is trying to separate out apologetics and polemics and clear them out of the way in order to uncover the history of what actually happened, you know, to the greatest extent possible. If you were to read a very large stack of books about the resurrection, and Allison has read far more books about the resurrection than any of us, I suspect, are ever going to have time or interest in reading, if you took that large stack of books, you would find the vast majority of them could be separated easily into two camps. On one side of the room, you could put all of the books by authors that before they started writing were already fully convinced to their personal satisfaction that the resurrection literally happened. And their motivation in writing is to convince you that they're correct. And on the other side of the room, you could put all the books about the resurrection written by people already fully convinced before they started writing that the resurrection 100% didn't happen, and they're writing to convince you that they're right. Allison isn't interested in either of those typical sides of the debate. He's part of a much smaller number of scholars in the messy middle who speculate that if something actually happened on that Easter Sunday, it was likely spookier, weirder, more uncanny, and this is the most important part, perhaps much more common than is typically realized. Allison is an interesting scholar. He describes himself as a Christian whose favorite spiritual writer is Aldous Huxley in his Neo-Vedanta stage. He's a Protestant whose favorite theologians are Origen, Gregory of Nyssa, Isaac of Nineveh, and Gregory of Palmas, all of whom are Eastern Orthodox. He's a Presbyterian teaching at a Presbyterian seminary who feels more intellectual affinity with Pascal and with William James than with John Calvin, who some of you remember burned our Unitarian ancestor Michael Servetus at the stake. Again, lots to talk about there. It's not my favorite. On the ways that Allison approaches the study of religion in general and the resurrection in specific, I find it notable that one of his major touchstones is the exact same quote from William James that I shared with you recently in my sermon on aliens and UFOs and UAPs. That quote is that we humans may be in the universe as dogs and cats are in our libraries, seeing the books and hearing the conversations, but having no inkling as to the full meaning of it all. In other words, we humans know those books contain knowledge that cat right there, as cute as that cat is, doesn't have the capacity to grok, and doesn't even have enough capacity to know that it doesn't have the capacity to grok. The same dynamic in turn may be true of us. There may be things happening in the universe that are orders of magnitude beyond what we humans simply have the capacity to comprehend or even don't even know what we're missing. As the philosopher J.S. Haldane said, the universe may be not only queerer than we suppose, but queerer than we can suppose. Along those lines, one of the biggest problems with most books that have been written about the resurrection is that they begin from the premise that the resurrection is an utterly unique phenomenon. From that starting point, the debate in all those books over here and all those books over here have tended to turn on whether that utterly unique event did or did not happen to one fairly obscure Jewish peasant more than 2,000 years ago. But what happens if we take a more comparativist perspective? There are many examples in the history of the world's religions of claims around bodies disappearing, especially after the deaths of particularly saintly or spiritually advanced teachers. I'll limit myself just to two representative examples from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but there are many, many more we could go into, and Allison goes into them in his book if you're really interested. This is in Tibetan Buddhism, or what are called the rainbow bodies. Some of you may have heard of this. It's especially notable that these reports are not about something that did or didn't happen one time thousands of years ago, but are said to still happen today. Here's one report from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. This is from 1953, about a spiritually advanced teacher named Manikingo. Just before his death, the old man said, "When I die, please do not move my body for a week." After he died, the body was carried into a small room, a little bigger than a cupboard, and it was noted that although the old man had been tall, the body already appeared to have become smaller. At the same time, a rainbow was seen over the house. This is the whole rainbow body thing. On the sixth day of looking into the room, the family saw that the body had grown still smaller. A funeral service was arranged for the morning of the eighth day, and men came to take the body to the cemetery, and when they undid the coverings, there was nothing inside except for nails and hair. That's way too fast for typical decomposition. The villagers were astounded, for it would have been impossible for anyone to have come into the room. The door was always kept locked. The window of the little resting place was much too small. Now, you can speculate about all things that might have happened. All the same things have been said about Jesus' body. But perhaps you can also see there are a lot of parallels between that Buddhist story and the story of Jesus being put into this tomb with this giant stone in front of it and nevertheless the body disappearing. Here's one more example. This is actually from 1988, and this is a story told by the Dalai Lama. He said, a young monk named Achuk told his disciples to seal him inside his room for a week. After a week, they opened the room to find that he had again completely disappeared except for his robe. And again, there are many more similar stories from the Buddhist tradition and from other world religions. So on the one hand, accounts of such weird and spooky and uncanny events would be much more satisfying to our 21st century worldviews if they were replicable in laboratory conditions. You know, they would be much more satisfying, as the late historical Jesus scholar Marcus Borg used to say, it would be much more satisfying if the resurrection had been a camcorder event. On the other hand, there's an intriguing possibility, which may or may not be the case, that if it is true, and it may or may not be, but if it is true that the body of a highly realized spiritual teacher can disappear in modern Tibet, then it could also happen in ancient Palestine. And when we adopt this sort of comparativist perspective, there's at least one essential other point to make. When traditional Buddhists share about the Buddhist rainbow body stories, only taking into account Buddhist traditions, they tend to be used as apologetics to prove the truth of Buddhism, or as polemics to prove the non-truth of non-Buddhist traditions. Similarly, fundamentalist Christians, when they tell the story of the resurrection in isolation, it tends to be used as either apologetics to prove that Christianity is clearly true because the resurrection happened, or these other religions are clearly not true because of the resurrection. A paradigm shift can happen when we notice that there are similar accounts across the world's religions. These are the points I try to hammer into my world religion students' heads over and over and over. Don't look at these religions in silos and isolation. Look at them comparatively. And from within a comparative framework, we can speculate that an objectively real event may be happening, but whatever is happening, if something is happening, it is being filtered and interpreted through cultural contexts. So perhaps a similar sort of objective event, so to speak, is occurring in each case. That is that all of us are human beings and not really that different from one another. But that same or similar event is, again, being interpreted quite differently by Buddhists or by Christians or by Hindus or by Muslims or by secular folks and due to their different cultural contexts. And like that cat in the library, in this grand scheme of things, we can go further and say that more may be going on in these unusual religious experiences than can ever be fully comprehended by our limited human perspective, even when we adopt a comparative perspective. So the comparative perspective can help us know more, but we're still limited. There's one final layer I need to add in when we debate the stories about Jesus's post-resurrection appearances or any parallels from the world's religions, is that we should also compare that to even non-religious secular experiences from a huge number of people throughout history who have claimed that deceased loved ones have appeared to them in some form. I have heard such stories from close and trusted friends and family members I've known for many years, as well as from members of this congregation, but those are not my stories to tell. I will say, for those who are comfortable doing so, who has either directly experienced seeing a deceased loved one or heard that from a trusted person? Okay, so a fair amount of hands. More widely, studies have shown that across the world, approximately half of all widows and widowers, half, it's a large number, believe that they have seen and or heard and or felt the presence of their deceased loved one. Sometimes, a spouse in particular, sometimes these encounters happen in dreams, other times they happen while folks are wide awake. Often these experiences are described as, quote, very vivid and very real. Now, again, of course, are there psychological explanations potentially for this? Possibly, stipulated. But again, the provocative question that arises is, if there are aspects to truth to these experiences today, might the same sort of phenomenon be happening to humans in the ancient world? If you're curious to explore further, one accessible entry point is a Netflix miniseries titled Surviving Death. Anybody watched one or more of these episodes? All right, I see a few hands. There are a lot of similar books and films and TV shows that, to be honest, many of them I'm pretty skeptical about and dubious. I think as they go, this is among the better ones, worth engaging. It's based on the work of the investigative journalist Leslie Kane, who's published in the New York Times and other really quite laudable outlets. Allison takes the risk, our biblical scholar we've been following, he takes the risk of sharing some of his own firsthand experiences. In 1987, one of his best friends was killed by a drunk driver. A week later, Allison awoke in the middle of the night, and he writes, "There, standing at the end of the bed, was my friend Barbara, who had died a week earlier. She said nothing. She was beautiful. She was brightly luminous, and she was intensely real. Her presence, it lasted only a few seconds, but it gave me great comfort." One afternoon, several weeks later, he says, "I was typing in my study in the full light of day, wholly focused on my work, and suddenly I felt a strong physical presence. It was up, it was behind, and it was to my left, and I knew immediately, I know not how, that it was Barbara." Allison also relays a story. This happened to his wife in 1994. She was with his father, whose name was Clifford, when he died. Allison was not present, and she said later, "Shortly after the doctor declared him dead and left her alone with the body, his spirit somehow returned, hovered near the ceiling, and told her quite clearly that he was overjoyed to finally be free of his illness. A few days later, his six-year-old son told him, 'I just saw Grandpa.' Allison writes, 'My father,' he said, 'had just now been sitting beside him on the bed, wearing his green bathrobe, the last piece of clothing that Andrew, my son, had seen him in. And my son responded to the experience pretty matter-of-factly, honestly, as children often do to these kind of weird, spooky stuff, and then told me that Grandpa had shared with him a secret, but that he couldn't tell anyone.'" And frustratingly, he doesn't go into detail. "Did your son ever tell you? I want to know the secret." A few weeks later, Allison said, "My brother John informed me that he had been walking down the street in public and had plainly heard my father's voice in his head. And when John asked, 'What did you think of the funeral, Dad?' the voice said, 'I don't know, I got lost.'" Months later, my brother told me that the voice returned once more and asked him to call a certain individual that he did not know and wish her a happy birthday. Upon making the call, he learned it was indeed the woman's birthday. There's more. His nephew reported seeing Allison's father, Clifford, at the internment. His mother felt her late husband's presence one night months later. His daughter had a vision of her grandfather one afternoon the next year. Two friends outside the family, not knowing any of this, also reported encounters with their father. So what are we supposed to make of such experiences on this Easter Sunday? Allison confesses that he chose to end his book with a coda, rather than a conclusion, because he's honest that ultimately he cannot connect all the dots. He cannot prove these in a way that is replicable in laboratory conditions. This non-ending loops us back to the possibility that we may be dealing with phenomena that are perhaps above our pay grade. Although Alice and I would agree that we should continue to seek understanding, scientific and otherwise, including just our direct firsthand experience that may ultimately be frustrating to others. But so often these experiences, you may not can convince other people, but when I talk to folks about this, that these things that they just know because they happen to them are some of the most important things that have ever happened in their life. So we should continue to seek understanding as much and as far as we can. This middle ground will no doubt leave theological conservatives furious because they want to prove the truth of Orthodox religious dogma beyond a shadow of a reasonable doubt. Sadly for them, I do not think that is possible. On the other end of the spectrum, secular skeptics may also be furious. Some of you may be furious because Allison is determined to keep the door open to the possibility that spooky, weird, uncanny religious experiences really do happen. Now, for some of you, I could end here with an invitation to perhaps just be a little more curious, a little more open to discerning and exploring the possibility of such mysteries. But since this Easter Sunday is also Transgender Day of Visibility and is a connection for the full service on TDOV that we did last week, I will invite you to hear a final note of resurrection hope in the form of a poem by my very talented colleague, the Reverend Gretchen Haley, about how life and love can continue on the other side of dying or on the other side of experiences that feel like death. When Jesus declares that even death cannot hold him back. Maybe what he means to say is that nothing can keep you from the life that you were meant for. Closets like tombs are no match for the power of a person radically willing to forge their own path, proclaim their own name, transgress norms, transfute truths, transform elements, and transfix the world in a story of love that transcends binaries and belief systems, love that calls all of our stories sacred and calls us all beloved, a love that is beyond belief. So when the crocuses find their way through the snow and the rocks, maybe what they mean to say is, we see you. We see new life, new hope, new possibility. We see you transmitting life even in the darkest of days, transcribing the future on our hearts, transversing the borders of gender, transitioning this world from judgment to joy, like it is our birthright, because it is. For this day and this life is a gift given to all of us equally, a transparent miracle, inviting us all to be finally free. In that spirit of working to co-create a more liberated, hopeful world, let's rise in body or spirit. Let's sing together hymn 276, O Young and Fearless Prophet.